Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening. Welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2160. That's 2160. On Wednesdays and Friday nights, we have guests that come on and they tell their story. Many times it's for the first time. And we're very, very thankful that they trust us enough to come onto our platform, and we give them that platform so that they can tell their story. And tonight we're going to have a wonderful guest. Her name is Nancy S. Allen. And she is from Dawsonville, Georgia. That's Dawsonville, Georgia. And she is a survivor of father-daughter incest. But before I get to her, we have a panel that's getting together here now. Before I get to her, I will tell you a little bit about NASCA, in case more people want to try and call in. And so that will give them a minute or two more to do so. And by the way, the number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. Okay. Let me tell you a little something about our mission statement. We're here. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two specific perspectives, and that is, number one, educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Also presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, which it is, it's worldwide, and that it does affect everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to the adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. That's only one of the many things that we do here at NASCA. Prevention, intervention, and recovery, though, is a big part, and it's certainly very important. I'd like to get back to the show now. Again, we're going to have Nancy S. Allen, and she is from Georgia, and she's a survivor of father-daughter incest. And I'm not going to say too much in the bio that I have here, because quite frankly, I like people to tell their story the way that they want to. I do let them know that we do it chronologically, earliest things that you remember, and we go from there. We do go to the panel maybe three or four times. We have a nice panel here. We have Laura, and I'm going to open up her mic and let her say hello and say hello to our guest, Nancy. Hey, hello. Laura. And we have a nice guest tonight. Her name is Nancy Allen, like I said, three times now, from Dawsonville, Georgia, and she is a survivor of father-daughter incest, and she will be our guest speaker tonight. I'm glad you're here, Laura. Okay, I really am. Okay, let me go to the other panels. I'm really happy you're here. Okay, we have Lisa from New York. My friend Lisa, say hi.
Well, hello, Carol. Hello, Nancy. Carol, we've had a couple of fantastic shows this week. Really, really great shows. And I hope this is one of them. And I'm looking forward to hearing Nancy's story.
Wow, thank you for that, Lisa. Yeah, and you know what? It's going to be a very good show, you bet. Okay, let me go down a little further. We have Joe from Oregon. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Right. I think you're sort of like my co-host tonight. Is that right?
Yep. Happy to be. Happy
That's
to
right
be.
For you. Because all of a sudden, names started falling in place. I know. Joe's here. Okay. All right. I like that. You do that better than I do. Yes, you do. Okay. So we also have Deborah from Arizona. Let me open up her mic and let her say hello. Hey, Deborah from Arizona. How you doing?
Doing good. Good evening, everybody. And Nancy, welcome. And thank you for sharing your story with us. Look forward to hearing it.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it, too. Okay, Nancy, I want you just to take a deep breath, and I hope that you feel comfortable. You don't sound nervous at all, and that's just great. What we deal with here on the show is very much what you're going to be telling us about. So I just want you to know you're amongst family members here. And now that you're telling your story, you, too, are a family member. So tell us what you remember from the earliest part of your life. Let's start there, okay? Nancy?
You want to turn on her mic?
It is on.
Oh, okay. Let me turn mine on then. There you go. I turned it on.
Yeah. No,
can you hear me?
Okay, good. Okay. Nancy, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there. But anyway, tell us about the earliest part of your life and start from there. Go ahead.
Sure. Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. It's been my privilege to be on the show, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk with you.
Well,
so the early part of my life.
Here.
Thank you. So the early part of my life, let's see. I'm actually from Massachusetts, and I've only been in Georgia for about 5 years. But I was born just outside of Boston, and I lived in a two-family home with my parents, my mother and father, and my paternal grandmother. It was her house. She owned the home, and we lived upstairs. My grandfather had died before I was born, and my father's sworn kind of a commitment to him was that he would take care of his mother, and he did that. My father was a very well respected man in the community, highly regarded. He was a podiatrist. My mother was a nurse, later studied and became a nurse practitioner. But my father had his private practice for most of his my early years, and my mother worked with him in his private practice as his receptionist and his nurse, and then later in the evenings, she would work a 3 to 11 shift. So she wasn't around very much. And so I was really cared for early by my paternal grandmother. We lived there with my grandmother until I was about 9. I am one of 8 children. I am the 6th, so I'm at the tail end of that list. And my oldest, we were very tightly close in age. My oldest sibling is 9 years young. I'm sorry, my oldest sibling is 9 years older than me, and my youngest were 3 years younger, and they are twins that are younger than I am. So my father, for the most part in my early years up until the age of 9, it was a very warm, I have a very warm memories of home life, being loved by my grandmother, you know, curling up with her cooking for us. My mother was more distant, partly because she worked a lot, but also because my grandmother tended to she kind of set my mother up in a lot of ways, pitting the kids against my mother, making her out to be, you know, that she was always working, so she was never there, so my grandmother would take care of us. And she kind of held that over my mother's head, which made it difficult for us as children to become close or connected to my mother. So she was a participant in the family, but she wasn't someone that I would ever really talk to or go to or really engage with. It was my father that I would spend more time with. My father was, even at that time, my father was a, he was a disciplinarian. He was very, very strict, but loving. And he would, at that age, he definitely was, physically abused and beaten a lot with belt kind of thing in terms of discipline. I was brought up Catholic, so there was a lot of Catholic guilt involved in the upbringing. But it was at age 9 that I moved to we moved to another town just outside of, a little further north in, of Boston, so it was more of a suburb. And this was my parents' first time that they had bought a house. So my parents were in their 40s, and I was at that point 9. But my older sister, who was at that time 8 years older than me, took care of us in the afternoons for the first year that we were there. And then I had my younger brother and sister who were twins. And then I have two brothers that were immediately older than me. And then I have two older that are 7 and 9 years older. So my oldest sister never moved with us. So she stayed with my grandmother. My next oldest sister did move with us, but she was going to private school. And so she was home, you know, for the first year she was home and, you know, would be the one that would make dinner because my mother worked 3 to 11. And then my older brother also wasn't home a lot. So within the first year there, my older sister went on to college and my other sister was still living with my grandmother and my older brother was probably there a year or two. So by the time that I was about 10, 11, I was left with my other four siblings that were closer in age to me. And because my two brothers tended to be fighting all the time, I was very often left in charge. So at 10, 11, 8 years of age, I was actually left cooking for the five of us, making dinner for the family. And I became like a little housewife, you know, for lack of something better. So life went on kind of like that. Until when I was 12, my father was always sick. But when I was 12, he had a massive heart attack and was one of the actual first quadruple bypasses that were done at Mass General Hospital. And so he came home to recuperate, and I was his little nursemaid while my mother was working the 3 to 11 shift. And that's what kind of started moving from physical abuse into more sexual abuse. And it started when I was 12. And I would take care of him. And he asked very specifically, it went from that I was giving him back rubs to he asking me to touch him. And then progressed from there. So I really started when I was probably just right around my 13th birthday. And it was
very hard. Let me just make a comment here. I want you to you don't have to like run through your story because we have an hour and a half. So, you know, like at times we're going to stop and discuss things and then, of course, go to the panel. You know, already you're showing you came from a large family. You did that really well, remembering the ages of your brothers and sisters. Holy crow. And what's going on here is so, so sad. And you know, it happens so often. It's just not right. It's just so awful. I mean, you became... at a very early age, you had to do the cooking and the cleaning and all this other stuff and in the house, like at the age of 9. I can already relate to that because the same thing happened to me. And then with your father being such a strict disciplinarian and being beaten, so many times all of us have gone through a lot of these things too. And then look what it turned into. Instead of being, you know, daddy being thankful that you're being such a good little girl at the age of 12, not quite 13, it turns into sexual abuse. And you know, I just want to tell you that I'm really, really sorry. I want the panel to say hello to you at this point. And, of course, the rest of us want to really, really hear, you know, your story as you progress and had the resolution of what you've done here. So let's go to Laura first, okay? Laura, do you have a question or comment that you'd like to make? Say hi to Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. I'm Laura. First of all, I want to give you a lot of credit. It's a big step to tell your story. And especially on a forum, a public forum, I give you a lot of credit. You went through a lot, and you're still here, and you're still surviving. And I just want to say I'm proud of you for what you're doing, for telling your story and sharing.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for that, Laura. Yeah, thank you for that. Lisa from New York, maybe you'd like to say hello and maybe a question or a comment.
Yes, I actually, excuse me, I have a comment. Before I do that, I want to say hello to my good friend Pollyanna out there in Oregon. yeah, anyway, Nancy, this story is going downhill fast, as they normally do, and you're doing a great job. And I want to what stands out to me personally, and people have heard my rants on this show, so they're used to it. But here's a guy that has letters after his name. He's a doctor, so when you try to come forward, no one's going to believe him. No one's going to believe you anyway, because he's a doctor and he's God, and he's been grooming the community and the family for a long time, and so. You're really on an uneven playing field right this minute, and I'm going to listen to the rest of your story because I'm going to have a lot more to say. You can bet that. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, we have Joe from Oregon. Would you like to make a comment? Say hi to her. Say hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I appreciate that. Complete of a background because it shows the progression and how slowly the tentacles sort of come in, and so I'm very I'm wanting to hear more about how you handle it and that. So, but thank you for filling us in on that. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're doing a great job. You really are. Okay, let's go to Deborah here from Arizona. Maybe she has something, a question or a comment to make.
Nancy, I applaud you for how well-spoken you are. And the first time I did this on NASCA, I was a little bit of a tearjerker. But you're doing a wonderful job. And as Carol said, to remember the age of all your siblings is just amazing. But I look forward to hearing the rest of I don't even know. I only have two, so I don't remember them. But you're doing a great job, and I can't wait to hear the rest of your story.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that, Deborah. Okay, let's go back to where you were. Your father was now starting to ask you for sexual favors, shall we say. He was becoming sexual with you. And yes. How did that make you feel? I mean, you must have. Tell us how you feel. I'm not going to put words in your mouth. Tell me how you felt about that. My God.
So it was a very confusing type of thing. At one point, early on, it was I felt special. I felt that of all the kids, he was now singling me out. And he was spending time with me more so than he did with the others. He would defend me compared to when we would get into squabbles, and it would tend to be siding on my side. It wasn't all the time. So in between occurrences, he would spend time with me. He used to have to take daily walks because of his heart condition, and I would walk with him. And on those walks, he would share more about his life, share about his relationship with my mother, share about how they met, share about what he wanted for all of us kids. He'd tell me he's proud of me. So there was this softer side that I craved, and mm-hmm. there was also this other side that was confusing. He basically told me that I shouldn't say anything to anyone, that people wouldn't understand, that he was doing this to help me learn that this was how, in a lot of cultures, parents or fathers taught their daughters how to be with a man. And that type of stuff. But as I grew a little bit older over that course of that next year, it started to get more, it progressed. It progressed into oral sex, both him to me, me to him. And it became something that I knew just wasn't right. I didn't fully understand. I was 13. And again, being raised very Catholic, sex was not something you talked about any time, anywhere, to anyone. And I started to really be confused. I remember one time when he had ejaculated into my hair. And I remember running from the room and I just had to keep washing it and washing it and washing it, and I couldn't get it clean. And just getting to a point where I cut it because I couldn't stand it. And then I was like, how do I explain that I cut my long hair to my mother? And I came up with some excuse, and she took me to a hairdresser to get it fixed because I had really butchered my hair. But the more that this continued over that next year, the more I started to try and stay away. But so let me back up a moment. My father, being an educated man, really felt strongly in education and in studying. And so I was very studious. I was fortunately, I was very intelligent. And I learned that if I was studying, then he would leave me alone. So I spent a lot of time with teachers. I became teachers' pets. I became a straight-A student. But also, he very frequently was the first person home after school before my mother did, sometimes even before some of my older siblings came in. So I got to the point where, to avoid him, there was a trap door in the closet in my bedroom. And I would pull myself up into the attic and sit in the dark with a flashlight studying for hours and hours at a time until I could hear who came in. If it was my siblings, I'd come down and kind of run around the other side and come back into the house. If it was my father, mm-hmm. I would sit just quietly and just wait for somebody else to come home because I knew that I would have an encounter if I didn't. So I spent a lot of time in the attic, really just, but then there were some good things that came from that, right? I spent a lot of time doing homework. I spent a lot of time reading. I had historical people who had gone through adversity were really people that I connected with. So Helen Keller, Abraham Lincoln, those are people that whose stories I couldn't get enough of. And they became my friends as I sat in the attic. But did that continue?
Can you see that though? Let's stop for a minute, honey. Okay, for a minute there. Let's go back
sure.
a little bit. You see, that's really. I want you to look at this. You first of all, he ejaculated into your hair, and
mm-hmm.
you felt like you couldn't get it clean enough. And I see that shows that you were feeling dirty. I can relate
mm-hmm.
to that heavy, okay? So you kept washing and washing and washing and washing your hair, and then you ended up cutting your hair in such a way that
mm-hmm.
you had to get it fixed and
mm-hmm.
all this other stuff, and then you ended up going up into the attic. Now, I can understand you going up into the attic and wanting to distance yourself from your father and you really fell into his into your schoolwork. It's really good for you, you know, that you had that and you were able to do that, and you also became the teacher's pets. You know, this is very good. I'm glad that you had that. You know, but it's too bad. Think about it. How you had to go up into the attic with a flashlight and sit there until your siblings came home, and how were you feeling during that time? Were you frightened? Were you? Do you realize how much you had to like hide to stay away from him? You're isolating yourself just to stay safe.
I mean, from a feeling perspective, I think one of the things that I learned in the process of this was to truly compartmentalize things. I learned very early that I could focus and get lost in what I was focused on. So I could be studying. I spent a lot of time doing math problems. I'm a math geek. And the more complex the problem, the better. And it was like the mind went to solving that problem instead of where I was right then. So I think in a lot of ways that saved me, that ability to do that. It became my addiction. It was focusing and digging into something.
Mm-hmm.
But from a...
Okay.
There's also the other side of it, right? I mean, I'm there because I'm terrified, right? I'm feeling not just afraid, but also confused and feeling guilty that I'm feeling that I should be with him, that I'm not doing what I should be doing, that I'm not helping him, and that I was obligated to help him, and yet I knew it wasn't right.
See, all right, now you're coming more in touch with your feelings there, and that's what I wanted you to be in touch with. You mentioned several things. I mean, you were frightened. You had to, like, you know, go in and go up into the attic, and even though you were getting positive things, but you also knew that you had all kinds of different feelings. And it's those feelings that so many of us can relate to, maybe different stories, but same feelings, okay? And that's what I wanted you to sort of, like, go over, and you did it very well. Thank you for that. So let's go on with your story. You're saying that... I know it has in front of me that physically and emotionally abused from early childhood at age 14, Nancy was briefly mandated into a kinship foster care placement by social services. Tell us about that. And why? How did that come to be?
Sure. So when this went on for about a year, and as the school year started to come to a close, I knew that I was going to be working in my father's practice and that he and I would be alone together a lot in between patients, you know, waiting for things, during lunches, whatever. And I knew that he would have access to me, and I was terrified. And my behavior started to change, and teachers picked up on it. So this is 1978. It's the first year of mandatory reporting for teachers in Massachusetts. And they, I had one of my teachers tell the guidance counselor, so I got called into the guidance counselor's office to have a talk. And it was a male. And, of course, I wouldn't talk. I wouldn't say anything because my father had always told me that if I said something, if I shared the secret, that they would take us away, that they would split us up and it would be my fault. And I was terrified of that. I was very close to the four siblings that were still at home. We were kind of like the five musketeers, you know, the one for all and all for one. Whenever we, you know, weekly would squabble with each other, fight with each other. But when my parents' headlights pulled into the driveway, we all just kind of ganged together and we were one. Nobody ratted on each other. We helped each other. So I, at this point in time, I you know, was trying to think about that if I said something, then I might separate the family and that it would be my fault. Just, I didn't say anything. So that after a few sessions, that guidance counselor referred me to a female guidance counselor, thinking that, you know, okay, maybe I'd be more comfortable talking to a woman. That didn't work either. So they basically referred me to a therapist. And my parents agreed to take me to a therapist. In between there, I just want to back up a moment. As I said, I was a straight A student, and during the end of the school year, at the eighth grade ceremony, that morning, there was a bunch of us living in a home, and we only had one shower. We had a 1.5 bath house, and so when you were showering, you left the door unlocked in the bathroom so that somebody else could come in and use the toilet if they needed to. Because in case they couldn't wait. So that morning I was in the shower taking a shower and my father came in. And after he had me give him oral sex, he then pushed me down into the bathtub. And this was the first time that he actually urinated on me. And then left. And I'm at a total loss. I'm devastated. How do I get up? How do I get into school? How do I even get dressed? I managed to get cleaned up. I managed to go into my room. My sister was in there. And 5 minutes later, it was weird that my father was still home because he wouldn't have normally have been home at that time. And next thing I know, he gives me this little stuffed pink hippo. And he hands it to me. He kisses me on the forehead. And he says, "Thank you, Payne Webber." And, that was a commercial from that point in time, at that time period. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what is he thanking me for? What? I don't understand. I go to school, and it's the school assembly, and I had won one of the major academic awards, and so they had notified the parents. And he's up in the balcony with my mother and my sister. And he's cheering me on. So there's this very confusing, how do we go from him peeing on me to him praising me all in the matter of an hour or two? So this is going on as this is going on as the guidance counselors are getting involved. So, at the end, this is the end of the school year, and so it's June or so, and I'm referred to a therapist. And while I was at the second time I was at the therapist, my mother went away for a week to a convention. And so I was staying with my oldest sister, who now had the apartment that we had previously had at my grandmother's house. And so I was staying there with her. And she was basically asking me, "Why are you in therapy? What can I do? How do I help you?" And I couldn't talk, but she left for work that morning. I was on a weekend. She left for work. And I, for some reason, I was going through her things, and I found some baby clothes. And my sister didn't have any children, but I found baby clothes. And I don't know, there was something connected me to her in that moment. And I wrote her a note. I wrote her a letter, and I told her what was going on. That then became, she took the note. She then called my uncle, my father's only sibling. And he took the note. And sometime that next week, I don't know how many days it was, but sometime that next week, she came with me to my therapy session. And she told the therapist what had transpired. But apparently somewhere in there, my uncle had left the note and my sister didn't have it anymore. But again, it's now mandatory reporting. I'm asked to go basically answer yes, no kind of thing. I can't speak. I can't get words out. And here I am curling up going, "Oh my God, this is exactly what he said was going to happen is happening. He was absolutely right. This is all my fault. And now what? So I went back. The therapist called the Department of Social Services in. They had me go back to my sister's house with her. My grandmother was staying with my younger brother and sister, who was at my parents' house. and my older sister was with me. So the social worker came to the house that next day, interviewed me. I was able to say a few things, but not coherently. And everything just felt like it was snowballing, that it was totally out of control, that I was powerless and voiceless. I was asked to come in. We went and we picked up my younger brother and sister. And I was asked to go to the courthouse. The police were there with my grandmother. I can remember my grandmother just crying at the door as my brother and sister are crying and coming to the courthouse. And I'm being interviewed, and I'm sitting there in front of a guy who I had no idea who it was in this tiny little room. And I couldn't speak. I just was looking at my feet the entire time. I'm 14. Mm-hmm. And apparently they asked if we could find someone to stay with. They would not allow us to stay with my older sister because it was my grandmother's house, and they felt that he would have access. So they would not allow that. So I remember my sister calling around to everyone and asking them to take us for a few nights, and everyone refused. My uncle refused, my aunts refused, and she must have made a half a dozen phone calls, and everyone refused. So we ended up in an emergency placement, my younger brother and sister and I. And I'm at this point, this is all my fault. I'm now dragging them into something. They were 3 years younger than me. They're terrified. They have no idea what's going on. And I remember being driven to the foster home in my sister's car with the therapist, with the social worker following. And my sister had this stuffed animal on the back of her seat of her car. And I remember just taking, it was a little yellow duck. And I just remember taking this little yellow duck. It was like a piece of safety. And she ended up leaving. And so then it was just the twins and I, just terrified, in a home where they don't understand what's going on. I'm feeling like I put them in this situation, and it's all my fault. And there are other kids in the home, but it was just so overwhelming that it was horrible, just overwhelming.
Let's stop here, okay? Nancy,
okay.
Let's stop here because I know that the panel wants to ask you questions. And, you know, this terrible feeling of guilt that you felt,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is all my fault, this is all my fault. So often kids feel that way, and damn it, it's not your fault. It never was your fault, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand the terror that they must have felt, you know, during this time, and you as well. Mm. Okay, let's go to the panel. Let's take a deep breath, and let's go to the panel and let them, you know, make a comment or ask you a question. Go ahead, Laura, you're up.
I have a simple question. Nancy, you talked about as things built up and got more, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but can someone tell me, do they call that grooming? Is that what grooming is?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. Did he what?
We're having a hard time hearing you, Laura, honey. Do you have your, are you just speaking into your phone or what? What's going on with you on that end? I can't hear you either. Go ahead, try it again.
Okay, let me try again. Can you hear me better? Okay,
yeah.
My cat
yeah.
is
mm-hmm.
trying to hold my phone too. as things built up and as you grew in the abuse scene to expand, is that what they mean by grooming? Does anybody know?
Are you asking me if he was grooming me? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been through a lot of therapy, believe me. And I've come to terms with, you know, my childhood in huge ways. And I see it for that's what it was. And I don't think he was just grooming me from that period in time. He was grooming me from the time that I was born. Right? I was taught to be submissive, taught to be, you know, what the girl is supposed to do, all of that. He absolutely was grooming me.
Yeah, as you tell your story, I can so relate to so much of what you said in my own history. So you're not alone, and I give you great courage for telling your story and for sharing it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're doing a fine job. You really are. Thank you so much. And
thank you. She really is.
Let's go to Lisa from New York. You have a question or a comment you'd like to make?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. And first of all, I have to say, this story has a lot of moving parts, and you're explaining it so nicely and easily. And I don't know about anybody else, but I'm keeping up with all the people and places and things and their chronology. So, I mean, no, this story has a lot of stuff going on. I wanted to say this.
Mm-hmm.
When you were talking about washing your hair, I thought of Lady Macbeth, who couldn't wipe the blood off her hands. But, of course, the difference was Lady Macbeth stabbed the guy. And, wow, I was just going to make a joke here. She stabbed the guy and you didn't. She couldn't wash her hands off, and you were the victim here, clearly. Two things I wanted to ask, actually two things. It may be a little bit premature to ask this now, but I will, since all these characters are now in the story. I wanted to know, were any of your other siblings abused? And regardless of the answer of that question, how did the rest of your siblings react to your coming out with the story? And also another quick question. It seems like that letter got lost in the shuffle. Whatever happened to the original letter that was given to your uncle?
Well, that became part of the story. So in the process of all of this, the reason that I was believed, even though I couldn't speak and because there was no note, was because my sister, that was 8 years older than me, came out with her story and told very vividly what he had done to her multiple years. And my uncle, his brother, and my grandmother, his mother, both knew about my sister, both had been advised about my sister, had tried to counsel my father. And so my uncle took the note and destroyed it. But in the process of listening to that and hearing my sister kind of explain and why this is all kind of coming out, it, to me, it was a revelation that my father lied to me, that I wasn't the special one. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, but I felt was I'm not the special kid out of all of this. Everyone else in the family had something in particular. My brother and sister younger than me, they were twins. I had a brother who had some special needs. I had another brother who was juvenile diabetic. This was my special, and that all of a sudden got pulled away, and I just felt lost. I felt betrayed by him, but at the same time, I'm feeling like everything's spiraling. I have no control. I have no voice. It's what's happening next. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let me say something to that. He made you feel as you were growing up that this is what fathers do to their daughters, okay? This is what they do. They teach them about life and how they're supposed to be when they get older. So he was like grooming you in the sense where he was pulling you in to justify, number one, what he was doing, and also, two, you were the one that he chose to have this with, so that made you feel special. That's why you mm-hmm. felt special. So a lot of times this happens to kids because they're told that they're special. They're the one, you know, where they're going to show you the ways of life, and many times they'll say, oh, you're so pretty, or oh, you're so smart, you know, all the things that go along with that, which makes you even feel more special. And of course, you were very smart, and you are very smart, so that would have been something that he would have said to you. And so I can see how that happens to children, where there is this grooming process that starts, goes on, and kids fall into it because they want so badly to have a daddy love him or her. You see what I'm mm-hmm. saying? It's mm-hmm. all a part of the special grooming process. Yeah. And when you realize what it is, now you just said that you realized all of a sudden that you weren't so special, you said, that this is just the role that you had to play because this is a role that he put you into, okay? This has nothing to do with whether you're a special person or not. We think you're very special, okay?
Well, thank you.
Well, you bet. Let's go down. Thank you, Lisa. Let's go down to Joe from Oregon. Maybe you have a question or a comment you'd like to make.
Yes, I here I was starting to feel good about the mandatory reporting and how in this one case it actually was working, except they totally blew it in their clinical and traumatic approach to it, because what it ended up being, rather than rescuing you from a traumatic situation at home, they created a more traumatic situation for you by taking you out and your twins out and putting you into a place without much explanation, as if it were more of a punishment for you. And so it's like, wow, that doesn't work either. So anyway, I just wanted to comment that all along, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I wish, you know, I wish somebody would have reported it or whatever. But in this instance, I don't know that that helped at all. Do you think it made it worse? Made it worse?
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
It absolutely made it worse. It absolutely made it worse. It.
And I'm sorry if I affected your voice. Yeah.
No, it's okay. I got a tickle. But yeah, no, it absolutely made it worse because the court system made it even worse on top of that. Because the next day I had to show up in court, it was not a private one-on-one with the judge. I was 14. My brother and sister didn't have to come, but I did. And I walk into this courtroom, and there's a judge up high, and I'm mm-hmm. asked to walk, you know, I don't know, 25 feet down an aisle. And in this room is my mother, my father, somebody I don't know who apparently was their attorney. On the other side is my sister, a different social worker. It wasn't even the same social worker from the day before. And in the back was my oldest sister and her husband, who the one that had stayed behind and I never really lived with. And there were a couple other people. So there's probably, I don't know, 10 people in this room, including two of my siblings, my parents. And I'm asked to stand in front of the judge as he's asking me, tell me what your father did. Did he do this? And I could not I couldn't open my mouth. I just stood there and cried.
Wow.
I could not open my mouth.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How traumatic. How insensitive. This is where I earn my Pollyanna stripes, Lisa, is that what a traumatic, insensitive way to handle a child like that. I'm sorry,
right.
But off my soapbox, going on. Anyway, yeah, I can tell that that was really traumatic for you, and I'm so sorry you went through that. It should have been a saving thing, not a rescue. It shouldn't have been another trauma like that. I'm sorry you went through that.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
When I went to court with my brother, my senior class had taken a trip to the courtroom, and they were in the courtroom when I was to testify. So all of my classmates had known or knew what was going on now. So I can relate to that. It's hard, very traumatic.
Thank you. I'm very
insensitive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was very, very insensitive, you know. And you have all these people looking at you and wanting to hear what you're going to say. And
mm-hmm.
you know, it takes me back to when I lived in New York and I was kidnapped and raped. I had cops all around all the time with their, you know, they had the guns and everything was, and I felt them, they would put me up on top of a file cabinet, had me look at mug shots to try and pick out the person that, who had kidnapped and raped me. And you know, you feel like you're under a microscope and you're scared, you're
mm-hmm.
frightened. You know, you feel like, you know, you just have all these terrible fears and thoughts going through your head. And, boy, it was right after that that I developed panic attacks, I'm going to tell you. I mean, I can relate so well. They're expecting you to speak. They're expecting you to come out with answers in front of all of these people. They're siblings, aunts, uncles, it doesn't matter who they are. Everything is focused on
lineups, you. They all look the same.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Oh.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can understand that. Let's go down to Deborah and see if she has a question or a comment that she'd like to make.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. What an amazing story. As Lisa said, there's so many moving parts. And I know we're all talking about that the being under the interrogation, and that is a horrible thing, and I'm so sorry you had to go through that. But I also want to point out, and yes, I have Pollyanna glasses too, Jill, just to let you know.
Thank you.
I do. But one thing that I'm so glad that you shared tonight is something that I've related to. With my abuse, I was locked in my room by my mother, and I was not allowed to come out, and I resorted to books and to math and to puzzle solving and to figuring things out and to finding new things and reading. Anne Frank was just my biggest thing. I was like, if she could do it, then I could do it. Like, that was so huge for me that it really pulled me through. And I've never heard anybody else say that ever. So thank you. So I know it wasn't just me, because I love that I can relate, because I would do puzzles. I would steal my brother's Legos, and if anybody knows my story, I dug a hole through my closet so I could reach through to my brother's closet, and he would give me Legos just so I could build something or do a puzzle. But reading Anne Frank and the Hello God, It's Me, Margaret, that's how I learned about menstrual cycles. So, but I've never heard anybody else explain it the same way and have the same feelings that I had behind it, because that was my escape. That did really make me feel good and make me realize that I could get out of it. And it sounds like that helped you, and whether it's felt like a punishment, it was still a blessing, and I'm glad you had that through this whole process. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was good. So we got a lot of information during these last few questions here and answers, and this is good. I want to commend you again for how well you're doing, as this being your first time, you know, like sharing your story, you know, openly here. And have you ever been on the radio before or anything? Anywhere else?
I have not been on the radio, but I do share my story. I've spoken in front of groups of live, in front of groups of like 200, not at this level of detail and not for this duration, but I'm pretty solid in where I am, and I feel it's important to share because my story goes on.
Oh, yes, it does. So let's get back to your story, okay? And, you know, you're helping so many people tonight. I just want to let you know that, because everyone loves to listen in on Wednesdays and Fridays especially, because people do tell their stories. Many times it's because they can relate to what you're saying. It makes them feel better. It gives them insight. You know, you're educating people. And then also, too, there are those people that don't know enough about child abuse and how it can make you feel so ugly and dirty and this is my fault. All the things that you mentioned that are so common that all of we who have been so abused do go through, okay?
Yep.
And then we have all that healing that we have to go through. And we have to come to the realization that it wasn't our fault. And then to go forward and to teach others is a wonderful thing. So thank you for that. So let's get back to your story now. All right, you're in the you're in the courtroom and all these things are happening. But let's go from there. You know, you're there and you feel like you can't speak. You've lost your voice.
You don't want to talk which is about something that actually.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was basically then escorted out of the room and asked to sit on a bench outside by myself, outside the courtroom, but in the building. And I did. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I don't know, it felt like hours, but I'm sure it was not that long a time. My mother came out and with my other sisters and my other sisters, my mother's crying. And then my other sisters are trying to console my mother and nobody's paying any attention to me. And I'm sitting on the bench just totally confused, totally what's happening. I don't know what the outcome is. And then my father comes out of the courtroom and he turns to my mother and he mouths to her, "I'm sorry." And he wouldn't even look at me. And then he walked off. And at that point, I got up and ran. And I went to the bathroom and I was just curled up in the corner of one of the stalls, closed the door and was just crying. And I don't know how long I was there, but my oldest sister came in, and the words, I'll never forget what she said to me. I mean, I know she was exasperated, and everybody's overwhelmed, and I understand that now. But at the time, what she said to me was, "Oh, for God's sakes, now what the hell's the matter with you?" I get it, but at the time, it was just another thing. And I was taken,
of course.
I was basically told that I was going to live with her and her husband, and that my younger brother and sister were coming too. So I ended up spending, so here I am at this point, right? Now I'm absolutely convinced. It's my fault, equally at fault. I mean, to me, the court just said that because he was ordered into therapy by the court. I was ordered into therapy by the court. He was ordered out of the house by the court. He moved into his office, which was a two-family house. I was ordered out of the house into my sister's home. So I looked at it and said, everything that he had told me was the truth. I am at fault, and the court just proved it to me. Mm. So it just reaffirmed everything for me. And so I spent... I spent the summer with my sister and her husband, and we would go to work with her. I mean, she wasn't prepared. I mean, she was only 23 years old. She wasn't prepared for to have three kids with her. She didn't have any children of her own. They weren't married that long. They had just bought this house. They had no furniture in some of the rooms. We slept on the floor in sleeping bags. And she basically took us to work with her. But I don't, now the Department of Social Services is involved. I was never asked if I wanted to return home. And I was never asked if I wanted him to return home. But by September, because I'm starting high school, I was brought back into the physical custody of my parents. And my father was allowed to move home as well. They felt that we had done okay or well enough in therapy that the social workers were actually in agreement that they could just drop the case and it was resolved. My father did acknowledge, and he did state that it was him, that he had done those things. He admitted to it in open court. And he did go through the therapy and deal with it in therapy. And so they felt that we should be reunited. And it was the court advocates that was actually the ones who said, no, they're not ready for this. So the state kept, the physical custody went back to my parents, but the state kept custody, and they checked in periodically. Within 3 months of being returned home, it started up again. And by this point in time, I was so traumatized by being removed from the home, by going to court, by all of this, that I swore I would never say anything again. And that spring, he got me pregnant. No! And I was very publicly pregnant. I was on a class trip with my old eighth grade teacher. And I was having pains while we were in Washington, D.C., and I was having such severe pains that he took me to the emergency room, and he stayed with me. And that's when I found out that I was pregnant. And so he's expecting that they were going to keep me. They actually left for the airport without me. And then they finally allowed me to go. And so I ended up in a cab to the airport and caught up with my teacher. And I'm still in physical pain, but I was just so glad not to be left behind. So he's expecting that when we get back to home, that my parents will either be waiting at the airport or that they'd have an ambulance or whatever ready for me. And instead, what happened was my parents basically said to put her on the bus to go back to the school. And so my parents met me back at the school. And so it was my father and my sister that picked me up. And I remember that night that my father and my mother were arguing, and my father screaming, basically saying, I haven't touched that whore, it's not mine. And my mother's just trying to calm him down, that, you know, she'll take me to the clinic in the morning. Of course, this is my father's clinic where he's now working because he had sold his practice. I honestly don't know whether I miscarried or whether it's too fuzzy, but I somehow lost the baby. But in the process of all of that, again, now I'm seeing my mother is not going to defend me. My mother is not going to stand up. My mother stayed with him. And at that point, it was just, I've got no out. I had no out at that point. And so it basically, he knew at that point that I would never say anything again. And I didn't, and it continued into my early 20s as a result of that. And it kept getting worse and worse, and he escalating. He used his medical knowledge against me. I don't even know how to put what he did. He would tie me down. He would use his medical instruments and just tight little cuts, and then pour alcohol in them. And he was just sick, and
yeah,
I can remember.
Sick. Yeah.
I can remember twice in there that I, once when my mother was away and he was just awful, and I remember that I used to have to put his pills out because he still had a heart condition. And he didn't know what my mother used to lay them out for him. So I remember sitting in the library, researching all of his pills, trying to figure out if I redid them different ways, could I make it look like he overdosed on his own? And then I'm in the library and I'm realizing what the hell I'm doing. And I'm like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And I finally just flew out of there and that didn't go anywhere.
Wow.
And then another time I was in his office and he was just brutal. I mean, and to the point where I had gotten sick and he basically made me clean up the vomit and made me eat it. And he then went and left me to clean it up and clean up myself. And the next thing I know, I went down the hall and he was laying in his recliner and he was asleep. And I just remember I had a knife in my hand and I stood there just shaking. I couldn't do it. I was like, I'm not him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it went on for a number of years.
Yeah.
I fortunately knew, having watched my older siblings, I knew that education was my only way out. And he had also told me that I was his until I married. But I also knew that I could not be financially dependent on somebody. I could not be my mother. I could not be tied to someone because of finances. So I ended up going to college. I of course, I'm the math geek, right? So I became an actuary. I found a school that allowed me to work, and that they helped me find a sponsor. So the company paid 2/3 of my tuition and fees up front, and I would go to school 3 months and then come home 3 months and work with them. And just to get out of the house, I also worked and went to school. The school was in New York, but I also went to school in Massachusetts, did all my electives, and then transferred them in. So I basically did a 5-year cooperative program in 2.5 years because while working full-time, just because it was my way out, and I knew that's what I needed to do.
Thank God you had that. Thank God you had that to lean on and to help you through. You had quite a story here, quite a story. You do realize, of course, that none of this was your fault. You do realize that today.
I know that today.
You know, you understand. Yeah. And the very fact of, that he continued on, even if he went back home, the incest resumed, and your mother, standing by his side. This is, unfortunately, we have too many stories where this can happen. And so much of the abuse happens right in the family, Nancy. They used to say, the guy down the street or the one standing, behind the tree, he's the one to watch out for. And we know that 93% of the time, 93% of the time, we know our abusers, and many of that 93% is from people right in our own home. It's only 7% stranger danger. I mean, look at what families go through. And you're scared to death to talk about it, at least you were, absolutely, because you didn't want to break the family up, and people were going to turn against you. And then you go through all that court scene, and I know what that court scene feels like, and you're afraid to speak. You've actually literally lost your voice. And all of these things happen to children. And that's why we have this show. This is one of the reasons why we have this show, because we're trying to educate the public the horror, the crimes, the heinous crimes committed against children and how it can affect them. Mm-hmm. Now what I want to get into you, or from you too, is a solution here, because it's already almost 9:10. I can't believe this went so fast. It says here that when Nancy was 28, her father died, and her repressed world exploded. She checked herself into an acute psychiatric hospital to begin her healing. Tell us a little bit about that. Tell us about this hospital. Go ahead.
Sure. So back up a bit. So when I was 15, I actually had met the man who would then become my husband. He was the first, he was my first boyfriend. And so I had, by the time my father died, I had two children with him. I got married when I was just after my 21st birthday, and I had two children with him. They were 1 and 3 at the time of his death. And I, he died on December 23rd. And I didn't understand. I had very effectively managed to compartmentalize things, and I had kept this from my husband as it was still going on, and I kept it from everyone at that point because I was terrified of what would happen at that point. So I was losing it. I was having nightmares and flashbacks, and I couldn't focus, and I was the breadwinner. My husband was the stay-at-home parent with our children, and I'm struggling at work. I'm going through like 2 weeks of this, and he had the children out, and I just remember sitting on the couch, and I had a bottle of pills in my hand, and I was just, I could not function. I couldn't, it was bombarded with feelings that I just didn't understand. And so I ended up calling a counseling place that was open 24 hours, and they told me to come right in. So I did. And they then took me to the hospital, and I was brought in, and I spent 19 days in an acute psychiatric hospital. And it was there that I met an amazing therapist who, with her, I walked through every relationship I ever had. By that point in time, my mother was living down in Maryland, and I'm still in Massachusetts. And she came up, and she came up, and she listened, and she took it, and she heard me, and she supported me. And I realized that my mother was just as much of a victim as I was, in just in different ways. Doesn't say that she shouldn't have been responsible for and taking care of things, but I was able to forgive my mother over the course of the next year. So I spent 3 weeks in the hospital. I came out, and I still couldn't hold it together. So I ended up going back in for another week, and then I came back out, and they instead did day treatments where I went to the hospital 5 days a week all day, and then 4 days a week, and then 3 days. And I had an amazing, amazing boss and department. I was a manager at this point, and I was terrified now. How am I going to now deal with, financially, how am I going to deal with this? My husband's not working. And I had to tell my boss, and I did. And he was just so supportive. It was the first time in my life that telling somebody I was accepted, and there was empathy and there was support. They did everything possible to support me in the work environment. Any accommodation. When I finally came back to work, I said to them, I've got a startle response. I can't handle things. I can't handle a guy hanging in the doorway of my office. I can't handle somebody coming up behind me, because I was freaking out still. So he asked me, what do you need? And so we came up with a plan that we were going to get all the males in the department together in a room. And he said, do you want me to tell them or do you want to tell them? And I said, I think I need to do it, but I need to read it. And he said, fine. And if you get stuck, then hand me the thing and I'll read it. And it was amazing that he was just so supportive. And every man in that meeting was, you wouldn't believe how many people came up after me afterwards and just told me how brave I was and told me shared stories of their own. And it was just, all of a sudden, it was just like the reality of, this is my family, and this is the almost the real world. This is what I was missing, just being accepted and not being blamed.
Right. This is what we go through, you know. It's a horrible thing. In many families, my story is totally different. They just didn't care. But in other families, you know, they didn't accept you. They saw the truth. They saw you had to go to court. They didn't want to believe what you had to say, and you had nothing to say anyway because you couldn't speak, and that too happens so often. So, you know, it's really, really an amazing story that you've told us tonight, and I think it's wonderful that you're working today. And also, too, that man, my God, where you were working, what wonderful people they were, you know, to help you, to just give you all the help that you needed. I think that's wonderful. How often do you find that in a workplace, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just outrageous. You know, you had all that support, the support that you should have gotten at home. Instead, like you said, it came from there, and that's wonderful. All right, it says here she wants to champion others to say, I am an incest survivor. Now, at one time, that was such a dirty word, such a terrible thing to speak about, you know. I am an incest survivor. People didn't want to speak about it, but the truth of the matter is so often in our own families, it is incest, whether the mother or the father or both of them or our close relatives inside the family are the ones who are abusers. And in my case, it was both inside the family, outside the family. It just was all over the place. And, you know, and then we have to get onto our healing journey. We come to the realization, you know, in time that it wasn't our fault. It never was our fault, okay? And so tell us a little bit about your podcast. It's called Tale of the Bell, I think it says here. Tell us about your podcast.
So if I may, just kind of need to back up. So as I, over the next two decades,
go ahead.
My 30s, my 40s, right, I thrived, literally thrived. I had an amazing husband who was the man that I met when I was 15. Because we had gone through this together and supported each other through it, like I knew he was there for me no matter what. So he was an amazing man.
That's good.
And we adopted two kids through the foster care system in Massachusetts, in addition to our own two biological children. So now I have four boys. And at the age of 49, my husband had also had some trauma involved in his own childhood. Completely different situation, completely different circumstances. But at the age of 49, it was this cataclysmic kind of perfect storm combination. I was away on a business trip. He was still the stay-at-home parent. I was away on a business trip. My then adopted twins were 14 and home with him. And he committed suicide. And my 14-year-old twins found him in the morning. And he was still seizing. And I'm trying to call from down in Georgia to help them. And he died. I was able to get a neighbor over and get an ambulance, but it was just too late. So I once again kind of came into this now what. I was living up in Maine at the time, and I was every other week coming down to Georgia to for work and working from home the other weeks. And once again, my employer just amazingly stepped up. They let me work from home for 6 months, and they were just amazingly supportive. The president of the U.S. Operations basically called me and said to me, "You tell me what you need." He says, "If you need to be out, you be out. You come back when you're ready. Do not worry about worried about pay. We will cover it." It was amazing the support that I ended up with, but at the same time, for 20 years, I had been okay. For 20 years, I had been thriving, and I was very successful. I was a vice president at work. I mean, it was very successful. We were involved in the community, and then this happened, and all of a sudden, where I thought all of this was addressed and dealt with and I was okay, it all came roaring back. And again, I'm in the closet with nightmares. I can't function. My oldest son moved back home from college to help me and with his girlfriend. And it was in that time period that the reality was, I went back into therapy, but the reality was, as I started to look for more resources, there weren't any. again, 20 years later, there still weren't the resources that I needed. I came down to Georgia. My company relocated me, and I came down to Georgia, and then I joined a Life After Loss support group for widows and widowers. And I've always felt different my entire life. And here again, I felt different. Not only was I younger than most of the widows and widowers, but I also was dealing with a suicide. I was dealing with becoming a single parent. Most of them didn't have young children. And I, on top of that, I'm an incest survivor, and I'm back dealing with nightmares and not being able to function and all of that. And I just felt so alone all over again. And so getting through that, healing through that, again, I had amazing support from friends, from a therapist, from family, my siblings, my kids. But getting through all of that, I made a determination that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to make a difference. So I went back a couple of years ago. I went back to my husband died in 2013, and I went back in 2017, and I became a life coach. I studied to become a life coach. And just this spring, I started a podcast, and it's called Tale of the Bell, T-A-I-L of the Bell, meaning the tail end of the bell curve. Again, I'm a math geek. And meaning, again, the outliers, the end of the extreme life experiences. And my goal really is to create a body of work where people can listen, survivors can listen, and not feel alone. That the way it's done is I've got about 9 episodes or 10 episodes out there right now, and I do a survivor telling their story. And then it's focused around a specific topic. And then if needed, depending on the topic, I'll have an expert come in and elaborate on the topic to expand upon it. So I've done things from dissociation to boundaries to when you have physical pleasure during abuse to activism to telling your story and all of those. And to me, it's been an amazing journey to get to that point that I can do that. But it's also been an amazing journey that the connection and the people that I'm meeting that are also incest survivors is just phenomenal to me. It's one story after another, and it's a community that's coming together.
Well, we think you're phenomenal. You've had quite a story and quite a life. And here now you have your podcast and also The Tale of the Bell, which is, I'm sure everybody's writing that down. I'd like to, see that myself. I want to go around the panel really quickly. Lori had to drop off, but we have everyone else here. And I know they'd like to thank you so much, for being on the show and for telling this amazing story. And also, too, I just want to tell you again, having gone through some of what you've gone through, actually a lot of what you've gone through, but not with the foster care system or all the other things, you have turned yourself into, with the help, thank God, of a lot of people, into an amazing person. And it's such a wonderful thing, and for you to have been on our show. And I want you to know one thing, too. We need people like you, especially when it comes to incest, A lot of people don't like that word incest, and why would they, okay? And yet so many of us have been through it, okay? So the very fact that you're bringing it out and you brought it out beautifully, that you told your story wonderfully, you can call in any time you want. You have our number, 646-595-2118. You know what time to call in. You can be on the panel. And you can help other people, who have gone through similar experiences such as you have. And, you'd make a wonderful panel person, okay? So please feel free to call in any time you want. And, and you are quite a good guest. Let me just go up to the top here and bring out on Lisa. Lisa, maybe you'd like to thank her, and we have to say goodnight in about 5 minutes. Not even.
Well, I'll tell you what. This was quite a story. This was I got to think about this for a long time to come. I say this every once in a while. This is a story I'm never going to forget. And on the same token, and there I was joking about stabbing him. Go figure. Ay, ay, ay. And then you said that, and I was cracking up. I am a wise ass. Everybody knows that. But this next comment, I mean straight up. A little bit. This one, I mean straight up. I deeply, deeply, deeply regret that heart attack he had when he got the quadruple bypass didn't kill him. I deeply regret that for you and for your family. And, you know, could have a truffle, but God made a mistake that time. So, anyway, come back another time. Let us know how you're making out. This was a very compelling story. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Lisa. Joe from Oregon, maybe you'd like to make a comment or ask a question.
Yes. I wanted to thank you. What a story of resilience. And I am ecstatic that your support from your work, that is so encouraging. I mean, I was thinking, wow, that would have been a nice place to work, you know? And that support, and you're building your family of choice through that. And then it was really sad about your husband. And
yeah.
But I think you've it's another resilience, and I really appreciate the podcast that you came up with. I too was wondering about Tale of the Bell, but Bell Curve totally makes sense. And and I'm going to listen to it because I too am an incest survivor, and I'm very interested in the approach that you've taken to bring on not only people who talk about it, but also people who can more of the expert knowledge type thing. So anyway, thank you very much for sharing, and I hope you come back and just be on the panel. That would be great.
Thank you.
Yeah, you did a fine job. All right, Deborah from Arizona, maybe you'd like to say thank you and whatever. Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll make this real quick because I see we only have 2 minutes left. But I just want to say, Nancy, you did a great job. There's so much more I would love to talk to you about. You did an amazing job. I will be listening to your podcast, but your resilience speaks for itself. You are amazing, and that shows who you are and what you are, and I greatly appreciate that, and I greatly appreciate you sharing your story tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for that, Deborah. Well, everyone, you heard a wonderful story, and again, on Wednesdays and Fridays, we have stories like this, similar, maybe not always all the same. We don't measure. We don't take yardsticks. We don't take rulers. Some stories are very hard to listen to. Others are not quite so hard. It doesn't matter because trauma is trauma, okay? And we're here six nights a week we're here. And we have different shows. If you go on the front page of our website, that's www.naasca.org, you can see every night what type of show that we're going to have on, okay? We have Community Matters, we have LACP, and we have other open mic type of shows as well, and then, of course, Wednesdays and Fridays. So I just got that little word in my ear that we have 90 seconds, so I'm going to have to bring this to an end. Yeah, I know. You're going to play the music for me, Joe, please. And
Yes, but anyway,
thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. You're a wonderful guest. You are very insightful. And you know, I'm sure that you helped educate a lot of people. And there's unfortunately a lot of people, too, that can understand all too well what you went through. And that's why we're here. So thank you so much. And I'm going to bid you all a good evening. And I'm going to say God bless to all of you and also to all those children who are still suffering from child abuse. Okay? It takes shows like this and books and everything else that we can think of to educate the world, and that's what we're doing. So thank you again, and good night, and please do come back, Nancy, okay?
I will. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Okay, good night and God bless.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Love Talk Radio.